My name is Kay Ross.
My name is Bob Mackey.
And you are listening to Watch Out for Fireballs, a Games Club podcast. And this week, we are talking about The Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask, which is an action RPG developed and published by Nintendo for the Nintendo 64 in 2000. And as you heard, we're joined by Bob Mackey. Thanks so much for coming on, Bob.
Hey, everybody. Not a problem. And it's my understanding that Gary did not want to go near this game with a 10-foot clown pole. Is that true?
Gary is done. I'm not sure if it was a clown pole. I don't think he specified. Mm-hmm. Gary is done with 3D Zeldas of all types.
I completely understand. Because from this era, this is really the only one I would ever want to replay when it comes to Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask, Twilight Princess, and The Wind Waker. This is the one I would easily go to out of all of those. And I really do like The Wind Waker a lot.
Yeah. I've never played Wind Waker, actually.
Wow.
That's surprising. I know, right? I didn't have a GameCube when it was contemporary. And by the time that we came out, I was just, I picked up Twilight Princess and bounced off of it. And I'm like, maybe not Zelda for a while.
Well, of course, you had a Wii U, right?
I did have a Wii U, yeah.
That's one of the 10 games worth playing. One of the, maybe three games that never actually went to the Switch quite yet.
I know, right? Did the Wonderful 101 ever come to the Switch, or is that still stranded?
Oh, I you know what? They did a Kickstarter for a modern-day port. I have it for Steam. I have to imagine it probably was on Switch.
Okay, yeah. At least as long as it's off of the Wii U island. I am a defender of the Wii U in the way that I am a booster for the Dreamcast. Yeah.
My mic arm is in the way, Kay, but you might not see this, but I assure you my Wii U is still hooked up behind me.
Nice. Yeah. And I like how when you listed off the Zeldas, at no point mentioned Skyward Sword. It is below mentioning.
God. I think I didn't mention it because I just want to erase that game from my memory.
You had to review it, right?
I was assigned to the review. This is some inside baseball. And then okay. I was quickly unassigned. It was given to someone else. I think because my EIC knew I was not going to like it very much, possibly. And yes, the reviewer did give a higher score than I would have, but we talked a lot about it. But it's a game I deeply regret spending, I don't know, 60 hours on. I really hated Skyward Sword.
Yeah. But I like Majora's Mask.
Yes.
I like this quite a bit. And so does the patron who executive produced this episode, Andrew, who I believe bought this and shows this for his husband as a Christmas gift or something like that. So here you go. So tell me your history with Majora's Mask.
Well, Kay, you did not have a GameCube. I did not have an N64 until the year 2001 because a friend of mine was looking to make some cheap money. I had a little pocket full and he was willing to sell me his N64. And so in the year 2001, I was really catching up with that platform. And the games were rock bottom back then. Nobody wanted them. And this was about a year after Majora's Mask came out, and all the things I heard about the game sounded very, very interesting. This time system, the limitations, the very dark tone. In the back of my mind, I thought, wow, I really want to play this. And it was not until about a year later that I actually get a chance to play it. And I immediately fell in love with it and immediately was getting furious that it seemed to be extremely polarizing online. Some people seemed to really like it. Some people were just simply offended by the idea of a game you had to play through more than once. And this is, the listeners know, well before the roguelite era. And that's one of the reasons why I really love this game. It's predicting a lot of things that are just inescapable in modern day gaming. I mean, at least gaming dating back to 15 years ago and later.
Yeah, absolutely. It was hard to, so like, this is the first time that I've replayed this in a very long time. I think that I took like a couple of bites out of the 3DS remake, but I didn't go all the way through it. But like playing it this time, it was hard not to think about this when it comes to the roguelike structure. And also just kind of the prevalence of time loop stories in games now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I was just thinking of how I really loved all of these games that were experimenting with this time system that seemed to just piss a lot of people off. Like, I love this. I love Breath of Fire, Dragon Quarter. I love Dead Rising. And I feel like I'm no super genius. I just kind of like to be punished, I guess, when it comes to playing video games. But a lot of people, they did not think that is the point of a video game. A lot of reviewers hated Dead Rising. A lot of people hated Breath of Fire, Dragon Quarter. It took us a very long time to get over the idea of, yes, you have to play this game again, but here's why.
I don't know that people, if they had listened to Bonfireside Chat, if we had gotten to it earlier, we could tell them knowledge compresses space, and the stuff you overdo, it goes so much quicker the second Absolutely. Time now that you know it. FromSoft should have released Dark Souls earlier.
I agree. I was sick of suffering through that decade of just very bad, very streamlined games.
Yes. So I had it. It was not my N64. It just became mine because it was my brother's. And I have a distinct recollection of Majora's Mask, you know, pretty much the same idea. Like, I, you know, was just fascinated by the concept, sounded adventurous, but I got it for, I think, my birthday or Christmas in 2000. And because I never had the hated and accursed Donkey Kong 64, I needed to go get the expansion pack. So like, I had to go to my dad, like hat in hand, like, can we go to Toys R Us? Cause I need another $60 thing or however right. much it cost.
That, yeah, that was a necessity to play this game. And by the time I got around to playing it, I think those were maybe $5 used.
Yeah.
There were so many of them because Donkey Kong 64, it sold an incredible amount despite how poor the game actually was.
Right. I was happy when Bonanza came out that I didn't see people like doing the, you know, revisit and revising up the opinion of a game. I didn't Yes. see a lot of DK64, apologia, I guess.
Yeah. No reevaluation there, and that's fine.
Yeah. Reevaluation. That's the word that I was looking for. But I like, it was this and then Shenmue, like a month or two later, like playing those in late 2000, just kind of in this, what if a game could simulate like a little world, you know, kind of idea, you know, where like each individual NPC would have their own thing to ask of you. And they would have their own kind of schedule that you needed to kind of learn or at least discover.
I'm really glad you pointed that out. That's something I think that is the core reason why I like games and games like this, not just for the time loop, but for the idea of the fact that you are in this world and people aren't waiting around for you. There's something kind of creepy, kind of voyeuristic about that often will make you forget you're in a video game. And I've always been fascinated by games that don't treat you as the main character often. And it's why I like games like this and Deadly Premonition and Hitman is a great example. The modern Hitman games are, they're just, the world is happening around you. You need to be where you need to be. And by playing the levels over and over again, you figure out when you need to be in certain places.
And if you missed it, well, improvise.
Yeah.
You know, Hitman is a little bit more forgiving for that because that's a game all about improvisation. Yeah, I remember when Oblivion came out. It felt like such a, you know, it was advertised as this bold and brilliant new idea, Elder Scrolls Oblivion, that the NPCs would have their own schedule. And I was like, hey, like 6 years ago. Yeah.
I'm not sure how advanced Oblivion was, but it's very adorable to go back to Majora's Mask because in my head, I feel like these characters have deep inner lives, and ultimately they go to one place every day, or often they will stay in the same place all day and their dialogue might change once. But still, there's enough there to get you to buy into the fact that this is a living, breathing world, as we used to say.
Especially as when I was younger and I had more time to mess around with it and discover that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I feel like every time I go back to it, I do find new dialogue that I'd never seen before.
Oh, yeah. So this is a direct follow-up to Ocarina of Time. You are taken to the realm of Termina, which is in the fiction, do you know, is it sold as like a parallel reality universe kind of thing in order to in order to hand wave the asset reuse?
Yes, I think that is the most they ever explain. It's an alternate version of Hyrule, essentially. And yeah, like you said, it's just to excuse the reuse of assets, which if you've never played Ocarina, it's not that egregious. And even if you have, you see how they change a lot of characters around. They honestly don't borrow as much as they could have.
I remember that is a criticism of this game that I find a little bit annoying, the asset reuse thing. And I remember being annoyed by it back in, contemporaneously when I saw that kind of pop up in reviews. I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. You know, it kind of doesn't matter. Okay, the farmer reuses a red-haired girl. Okay, yeah.
And I guess we didn't know at this time we'd be seeing Gorons in every game. So we're like, oh, again with the Gorons.
Exactly. But once you're there in Termina, you have to save the world because the moon is about to crash into it. There is a little imp kid with a cursed mask, and you have 3 days in order to get that mask back and stop the apocalypse from happening. And the fundamental play in this is pretty much exactly the same as Ocarina of Time. You're Z-targeting, you're, auto-jumping, the kind of context-sensitive buttons, things like that. We covered Ocarina of Time on episode 270 back in 2020. You can go back and listen to that if you're, curious, playing this vicariously. But I think you understand what a 3D Zelda is, probably. I meant to bring this up, too, when we were talking about histories with this. You had a Retronauts about Majora's Mask here relatively recently, right?
Yeah, like a little over 3 years ago. And that was my last big replay of the game. But I feel like at this point, I have played through the game 5 times. And I was revisiting footage for this podcast. So I am like a Majora's Mask podcasting machine at this point. And it actually... Yes. I didn't mention this. That was the reason I first appeared on Retronauts in 2009 as a guest. So honestly, hey, I believe the first video game podcast I was on was your college radio show in probably 2008. And then shortly after that, I was on Retronauts as a call-in guest in 2009.
Oh, that's awesome. Huh. Yeah, I didn't know that was your, your first one.
Yep.
Neat. So the structural change we've kind of alluded to is this Groundhog Day, kind of deal that's going on. You have 3 days. It takes roughly an hour if you don't use the slowdown time song, which cuts it, by a third, gives you 3 hours to do everything. And at the end of that, you have to play the Song of Time to kind of reset back to when Link arrived in Termina.
Yeah, I think people hear that and immediately don't want to go anywhere near this game. And honestly, with both of our experience, I think we can both say you have more than enough time, especially if you play the slowdown time song. And then the 3DS version basically makes the whole time equation completely irrelevant with all of the safeguards they built into that remake.
Yeah, I've got a whole section for the 3DS changes that were made. A criticism of the game, the N64 version, which is regrettably the easiest one to play right now, I think, is like, okay, I understand people saying it stresses them out, but the consequence for failure is so low, especially when you consider that a great deal of what you do in the temples is just getting the items that you need in order to make the beeline for the boss, right?
Yeah, ultimately what you lose is consumable items, and there's even a bank in the game that can somehow keep your money intact despite the various apocalypses you suffer through. It's FDIC insured, I think. That's why.
It's not just across time. You can show up as a Deku Scrub or a Zora.
Yeah.
That person always recognizes you as Link.
You can commit identity theft in this game.
Yes. Otherwise, things kind of reset. There are times where this, can get annoying, especially like you have more than enough time for a dungeon. I did end up having to regather some of the stray fairies, those collectibles that are in that are in some of the dungeons, because some of those are pretty tricky to get a hold of. But you have control over this to a degree. You can slow things down. You can skip time forward in the N64 version. I think it's like in 6 hour increments. In the 3DS remake, you can pick the hour that you want to warp to, so there's less killing time as you do this. Another major change here, as we alluded to, you do transform. You get masks that let you turn into Zelda critters. These other, kind of like races that make up the world. So you find these masks that let you turn into a Deku Scrub, a little plant person, a Goron, big rock guy, and a Zora, a fish person. And they all have different capabilities.
Yeah, and this game is really ahead of its time when it comes to the idea that Nintendo is currently obsessed with, because Mario Odyssey, great game. What does Mario do in that game? He transforms into different forms. Donkey Kong Bonanza, great game. Donkey Kong transforms. And I feel like they're all kind of cribbing from Kirby, but it feels like we're working our way to one unified grand Nintendo one game theory where a Zelda game and a Mario game and a Donkey Kong game will be like indistinguishable from each other in 10 years.
Yeah. Just like what? There's carcinization for everything evolving into a crab, and then there's Fortniteification. Yes. Eventually it gets all going to be a shared universe.
Yeah, this is Kerbification, I guess.
Kerbification, yeah.
Yeah, because I've not played all of Tears of the Kingdom yet. I really wanted to go back to it, but I don't think Link transforms in that game.
I don't believe so, but I didn't play the entire thing. It was intimidating. but this is neat. Like, this is a really fun way to give you new verbs, new capabilities, right? Normally in Zelda, and it is this to a fault, it's formulaic. You unlock the ability to do new things one at a time by getting the key item in a dungeon that is built around that, with a boss fight that is built around that item. And then you move on to the next one. With these, it gives you four different modes that you can swap to at any time when you're roughly like two thirds of the way through the game.
Yeah, it feels like they say to the player, we have heard your complaints about Hyrule Field, how you hate running across it. Well, now you can roll across it. If there's water, you can swim across it. We're still going to give you a horse, but you will never use this horse. You will use the horse to jump one fence, and that'll be it for the rest of the game.
The horse is a key, is what it is.
Yeah, Epona is just a key. And I guess you leave on Epona. She gets you there and back.
Yes. Yeah, basically a key and mass transit between dimensions, I think. You can roll across the map, or you can put on the rabbit mask or the rabbit hat and run across it at a startlingly quick pace. Mm-hmm. That is another way that you can manipulate time, actually, is by moving faster. And that's one of several kind of non-transformation masks that you get over the course of the game. Some of them have functionality and are important, like the rabbit mask, the great fairy mask. Other ones are just quest coupons. Mm-hmm. There are coupons for these side quests. There are so many of them that you could say the emphasis is more on them, because there are fewer temples in this. There are only four compared to, I think, nine in Ocarina of Time.
Right. And we'll talk more about the development later, but it feels like that was their answer to the idea that it's a lot more demanding to design a dungeon than it is to create the space and create quests in this space. So they're doubling down on the idea of the mini quests are the most important thing here. And one great little invention they give you is the bomber notebook, which I feel like shouldn't be in a game of this vintage, but it's a great help that it's there. And it lets you track, here's where certain people are going to be, here's where you are in their quests, here's where to look for them. So like, you could be writing all this stuff down yourself, but I like that it exists within the game.
Yes. It's a quest log at a time when, it is hard for me to think of one that had one that was as responsive as this, right? Usually it would be a very vague to-do list, right? I think that is important, when you are, especially for the schedule, the schedule idea. And also just, it's hard to remember, when you came across something that was, noteworthy or would have, you might not even know that it tied in to a quest that you might have to do to get a reward, right? And the four dungeons that are there, they're really big. I feel like they kind of make up, it's fewer in quantity, but each of them feels like one and a half, Ocarina of Time dungeons a little bit to me.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but they all feel very vertical to me.
Yes. Yeah. Like three of them at least are like towers, right? Yeah. And that was different too. Like going back, you know, 5 years ago when we played Ocarina of Time, you know, really noticing and seeing how much it was a 3D version of Link to the Past, right? How relatively flat everything felt. This did feel like a departure. And there are like little and like dungeonlets on the way to the big temples as well. You get like a Kana Castle, or you get the Deku Palace. So, you know, to just focus on the number four for these is a little bit misguided, I think, when you talk about this, you know, complaints about the game.
There's lots of larger spaces with combat and puzzles in them that aren't necessarily one of the four dungeons.
Yes. Defeating the dungeon, beating the dungeon will change the world state in that temple's region as you solve some of the problems. This is a little bit annoying when you are doing quests after you have cleared the dungeon and you run out of time if it took a while to find all the stray fairies or whatever. And then you have to restart and then go back and then defeat the boss of the dungeon again.
Yeah.
I did find that a little bit tiresome.
I mean, we'll talk about the differences, but this was a lot more manageable in the N64 version when the bosses were a lot simpler to defeat.
Yes.
And a lot easier to cheese. And ultimately, I wish there was just a lever you could throw to change the world state once you beat the dungeon, but they wanted you to challenge the boss again for some reason. I really don't know.
It should have just been a song, right?
Yes, yeah. Or a song. That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. We talked about the quests and things like that. You can get hints about these too. You can wear a special mask and talk to the gossip stones. Normally if you just hit them, it tells you the time, which is cute. And the 3DS version also adds in, kind of shake a stone, hint system where you can go in and see little videos. This was part of Nintendo's little effort to build guides into games, or at least, in the extreme way, like in the Wii U era, like just press the button and we'll play the section for you. Like it felt like they started trying to do that for a while.
Yeah, it was very strange. I guess maybe some people found it useful, but they were very protective around this era. They felt like helicopter parents because, like, oh, do you need help? And then on both the Wii U and the 3DS, there would be these things that would pop up every once in a while, these messages like, oh, you've been playing for 3 hours. Don't you want to take a break? The insistence on breaks was something that was very much part of that generation. And I've never seen in the Switch and beyond Nintendo saying, hey, move your legs. Don't die of a blood clot. Get up. you've been playing Breath of the Wild for 14 hours. Are you okay?
Yeah. They just we will call the authorities to do a wellness check.
Yeah.
You know, there's no like, oh, you reached the end of Netflix. You know, kind of
yes.
Are there any other gameplay differences that I didn't include here? Just about Majora's Mask generally. I've got the specifics about the 3DS changes.
I'm sure there's like a few little tweaks. I want to say that maybe Link's swordplay is a little more advanced, but I can't really recall offhand. It seems like because you don't get to be an adult, they gave you a few extra moves with the sword.
Yeah. I would have to play them back to back in order to tell you.
Yeah.
The fact that you are always Child Link in this when you're not Zora or Goron or any of that, they fix that by just having it so that Child Link can use every item as well.
And the Child Link thing also pissed a lot of people off because I'm sure you remember this, Kay, the discourse about Zelda and how after Ocarina of Time came out, we want the dark Zelda. When will we get the mature Zelda? And this is the most mature Zelda you'll ever get. It's about like an apocalypse that happens over and over until you save it. And then I guess they were happy when they got Twilight Princess. But to me, this in my heart, this is the darkest Zelda.
I just remember the people crying at the E3 where Twilight Princess was unveiled. Even at the time, I was a little bit embarrassed.
I guess you kind of made it look like Lord of the Rings. Sure, I'll still play it.
It was people who had played it, you know, any of these games as a kid, wanting it to grow up with them and not recognizing that they got that with Majora's Mask, right? There's like weird little theories like, oh, each of the areas represents a stage of grief or whatever. I think that's a little bit silly, but like as a game that deals with specifically how people maladapt around grief, around the idea that things might be ending, you know, and the denial and stuff there. Like, yeah, this is, you know, pretty resonant for adult kind of themes.
Yeah, nobody is a good hang on that third day. It's a bad time.
No, not at all. This is one of the best looking N64 games, moving on to aesthetics here, due to the fact that it required that expansion pack that I didn't have. A lot of games made use of this, like Star Wars Rogue Squadron looked sharper if you had this when you played it. You needed the expansion pack to play like the single player version of Perfect Dark. Hmm. At the time, this was one of two games that required it, though. And Donkey Kong 64.
I also believe that it was not just superficial qualities. The RAM was necessary to help out with all the schedules of characters, keeping those running in the background while you were doing your own thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it made a difference. And like the visual side of it, too, is like, I would consider having a longer view distance and, you know, less popping and stuff. Like that actually is a gameplay concern as well, mm-hmm. You know, for me. So yeah, there was a bunch of stuff that improved, you know, kind of at the tail end of that era where consoles kind of had these weird little half steps, right? Before we got the pro versions again, blah. This is also more colorful than Ocarina of Time. I just like it more visually. Ocarina of Time, it's blues or it's greens and browns kind of the whole way through.
And I mean, I guess, the town that's your main hub is setting up for a festival. And this mm-hmm. time around, the town is actually consisting of polygons. It's not the pre-rendered smeary mess that was, Hyrule Castle Town.
It doesn't turn into a Resident Evil game.
Yeah.
Some people complain about the reliance on asset reuse, but that was a necessary concession for the development time on this. I also like it that there's the sense of familiarity, and this might be somebody I recognize, but they're serving a different role in the story or they have a different personality. Like that unsettled me in a great way back when I played it as a kid.
Yeah, it does add to the nothing is as it seems kind of atmosphere, even though, like we said, it is just to get this game out very quickly before the N64 is just a non-starter for anyone.
Yeah. They were just looking down the barrel of the GameCube launch at this point. I mean, this came out, the PS2 was out. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
I think honestly the same day. It might have been the same day.
Did it?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. I like the music in this. I think that the instrument palette variation in between the different regions is nice, but it doesn't stick. I'm not as big of a sucker for the Ocarina of Time soundtrack as a lot of people are. So like I can't make like a hugely meaningful comparison between the two.
I guess a lot of classics come out of this, like the Song of Healing is a big one for Zelda fans, and the Clock Town theme and the Skull Kid theme. I guess the only downside is the Nintendo 64 instrumentation, which is never great. But you know what an N64 game sounds like, so you're not surprised.
Yes, it is not like a downgrade at that point. Have you fallen down the rabbit hole on YouTube of looking up arrangements of popular albums in the Mario 64 sound font?
I think I have done it a few times. Honestly, I'm more interested in getting the soundtracks processed in the purest form with the most high quality versions of those samples. They find the libraries those samples came from, and then they reorchestrate the song. That's fascinating to me.
Yeah, that was part. That's all thanks to the Mega Leak, right? Or Giga Leak, or whatever they called it.
Yeah, I believe that was a huge part of it.
Mm-hmm. But the major win here, I think, aesthetically for this is the tone. We talked about the melancholy of this, but also the surreality. You know, like you have people who are, you know, oftentimes in denial. You have people who are trying to line up their affairs. You have people who are, you know, trying to find a dignified way to end one's trying to run. And you kind of play a role in helping them. You are helping them through this temporary setback in order to get heart pieces, mostly.
Yeah, because of the way you play the game, you will not experience all of the content usually, because you're not going to be hanging out on day 3 of Clock Town just to talk to people. You're going to be probably trying to finish a dungeon or something. So with every gameplay, every time I come back to the game, I do learn a little more. And the last time I played it, I did find something new, and that is the Swordmaster. You can actually open a secret back room in his little hut on the last day and watch him cowering and admitting, like, I'm not a hero. I'm a failure. It's very, very tragic. And I probably played like 100 plus hours of Majora's Mask, and I never encountered that scene before.
Yeah, I've never encountered that. And I think that's important to say. We're not going to call out every single one of these. Even every side quest. There are a lot of them that are just like, hey, engage with this mini game. If there's a favorite moment that we, do not hit, do not feel slighted. It's just it's a very, very big game. We're going to hit the big ones, though. I like the humor in this a lot. A lot of stuff that just feels like weirdly off color to it. You know, the person in the toilet at the hotel who needs paper, needs something to wipe with, but he is inside the toilet and he's just a ghastly arm kind of reaching out of it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The toilet man, very disgusting. And a lot of the humor in this game and a lot of the dark tone is chalked up to a guy named Yoshiaki Koizumi, now a very big wig at Nintendo. He was responsible for the storyline here in the weird tone and in Link's Awakening. And I'm looking at my independent notes I took for the other podcast. And
Thank you.
I guess that Miyamoto hated this tone so much that after this game came out, he told Koizumi, "You're never writing a Zelda game again."
Oh, no.
But I will say that dark, weird tone does carry forward afterwards. It's not as intense, but Zelda games always have just like this kind of weird, sinister tone following Majora's Mask. They have kept it up to some extent.
Yeah, and I'm happy that you called out the commonality with Link's Awakening, which does feel of a piece with this. Was that writer the person who was it that brought David or the Twin Peaks guy Mark Frost out to talk about?
Yeah, I forget who it was, but that was a recent discovery just because Mark Frost tweeted about it one day. I guess he retweeted the anniversary of Link's Awakening. Oh, these guys brought me out one day. They wanted to talk about Twin Peaks or something. And yeah, I forget who it was, but that's how close they were to that material. They just flew out the creator to talk about weird stuff.
Yeah, I love it. And it's probably not a coincidence that Link's Awakening and Majora's Mask are probably my two favorite Zelda games.
They're great.
So I've got some of the development story here. If you have more details from your notes that you did on the Retronauts episode, please fill them in. Or if I got anything wrong here, this began as the product that would eventually become Ocarina of Time: The Master Quest. They wanted to make a remix of Ocarina of Time in order to have something to sell with the accessory that everybody loved and was sure to be a hit, the Nintendo 64 disk drive.
Yes, and like these were really engineered for asset reuse because there was the Ura Zelda and then Zelda Gaiden were the two like spin-offs of Ocarina of Time for potentially for the disk drive, it sounds like.
What was Zelda Gaiden? What was the concept behind that? Because I'm not familiar with that.
So Zelda Gaiden is what transforms into Majora's Mask based on what I was able to find. And then Ura Zelda eventually surfaces in the form of Ocarina of Time Master Quest. I think they wanted to do a more... they wanted to transform the original game a bit more like the second quest in the original Legend of Zelda with that Ura Zelda. But it eventually came out as that kind of... barely changed Master's Quest.
Yeah, because I remember reading something that lines up. So the idea that like there were potentially two different projects or maybe different stages, because like there's some stuff in Majora's Mask that started in development for the previous concept, like the Beneath the Well section with that very annoying Gibdo fetch quest.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. I think that was originally supposed to be for, slotting somewhere into the Ocarina of Time world. But people on the team were not satisfied with the idea of just kind of making roughly the same game over again. And Eiji Aonuma and Shigeru Miyamoto were like, okay, well, if you want to come up with something more ambitious, you have about a year to do it. Yeah. So, and yeah, they had a year to do this. They developed this over the course of 15 months. In contrast, Ocarina of Time took 5 years to develop. not all of that was making the content of it. It was, you know, making the engine and stuff that they were able to reuse later on and a lot of the assets, but that's still a lot of crunch, especially for something that feels as different as this was.
Yeah. This game should not have been made in a year. I don't know how it was, even though it's a much more low tech game than what you would see today, obviously 25 years later. Ocarina of Time was in development alongside Mario 64. It was delayed a lot. I think people might forget that now, that it was not always intended to come out in 1998. They wanted to bring it out a lot earlier. We had to wait through like another holiday season before it came out. And yeah, I'm not sure if you heard this, Kay, but always Nintendo people are always putting themselves in the games, caricaturing themselves. And I think you can make a compelling argument that Miyamoto is the mask salesman, because he is always a smiling, happy guy and
making unreasonable demands.
Yes, exactly. But with a smiling face. So I think they don't want to directly say that about their boss, but in terms of comparing him directly to the mask salesman. But I have heard that Miyamoto is the kind of guy who will give you an unreasonable demand and be like, oh, yeah, and you'll do it, right? Of course you'll be able to do it. So it is like the beginning of Majora's Mask. So I like that the Majora's Mask as a whole is also a metaphor for the strenuous 1 year or 15, 16 month development cycle of a video game, where this smiling taskmaster is making you do an impossible thing and just saying, oh, well, yeah, you're going to do it, right? I know you can. Go off and do it.
Right down to do it again.
Yes, yes.
Do it again, but better this time. Yeah.
And he's got a little bit of a mean streak too.
Yes. Like any of those auteurs, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I never noticed that, but that does make sense. And you said, oh, I don't know how they did it. They did it by how every studio does it. They chewed through work staff. This was a really stressful, development. People were having nightmares. There was a ton of crunch. And a lot of that turned into some of the tone, like people being crotchety was like people expressing their own dissatisfaction with their working conditions.
Yeah, I mean, crunch is always bad, but it does seem to make games a lot weirder if they're finished. And in doing research, I don't know, like 4 or 5 years ago, I learned that Kid Icarus was a big crunch game for people at Nintendo, and they were really filtering their super dark feelings through that game, which is why it is so vicious and strange at times.
Huh. You know, I've never been a big Kid Icarus fan.
Me neither.
Yeah.
I do respect it just for being weird, though.
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, not a fun game to work on, although, very creative. Like the main concept for the game came from a daydream. The horrifying Deku transformation sequence, like one of the directors had a nightmare that involved Deku's, and then the next day somebody came up and like showed them this scene, like, oh, I came up with this Deku transformation thing. I'm like, yeah, we have to use that, is an anecdote that I have heard from this. And the time loop, I need to know what this original game was going to be. Co-director Yoshiaki Koizumi's, he brought this kind of cops and robbers game that was meant to be replayed over and over again to this. Do you know anything more about what that might have been?
I've only heard the premise that it is a cops and robbers game. If I had to guess, maybe it's something where you have to play these missions over and over to learn, like, okay, what is the heist? What does it entail? Where are the criminals going to be? What are they going to be doing? And as you play it more and more, you learn more and more about the plan.
Yeah. Oh, you tried to stop them at the front, but they were tunneling in under the bank or whatever.
Something like that. I mean, that's kind of what I want it to be. It could be much different, but it seems like that could be a likely version of it.
Yeah. In terms of near misses, things that they had explored with this, when it was on the N64 DD, they wanted the time loop to be 7 days long and to progress in real time.
That's insane.
Yes.
And that would not have been fun, and they could not have made this in a year, or 18 months, or hell, even 5 years.
It was a neat trick when they did the real time day and night in Pokemon Gold and Silver.
Mm-hmm.
It was also annoying.
Yes, it could be. It could be. Especially if you only really played at nights, or in their case, night started at 5 p.m., I think, sometimes.
Yeah. Like, oh, okay, I came home from school, watched DBZ, and now it's nighttime at my Pokemon game. It is the year 2000, and I'm in hell. they weren't like completely dissatisfied with the product that came out at the end of this, but upon revisiting, there was, you know, a lot of stuff that was just like, it ended up that way because of the suboptimal development. And this kind of became what Aonuma would call the what in the world list. Shortly before the 3DS remake, went back and played it, I was like, what were we thinking? Like, just about these individual decisions for this remake. We got the remake because Majora's Mask is well reviewed. It's a Zelda game. It probably was going to be. Also, it's really good, but it's still divisive, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like this used to be the hipster choice. Also, no one says hipster anymore, so I guess you couldn't say that. But this was the Zelda snobs Zelda, I guess. And it was not. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
It was the Kid A to Ocarina of Time's OK Computer.
There you go. That I like that comparison, but that's not why I liked it. But I felt like sometimes I did feel like, oh, people might think I'm a snob, like a video game snob, if I'm like, well, actually, Majora's Mask is the best Zelda of that era. But I feel like we all got used to these kind of mechanics. We all knew that Zelda would move on and take different forms, and we're okay with that. So I feel like now people are more welcoming, and now it is considered a beloved game that's not very polarizing. Sort of like Final Fantasy IX is another one of those where it came out, people were like, this is for babies and I hate it. And now everyone is celebrating sweet little Vivi and all the other characters, and they love it. That's not what it was like in the year 2000. Also another year 2000 game.
Yeah, God, what a fucking year. Wow, people talk about 1998. 2000 was another whole other thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the 3DS remake of Ocarina of Time was really successful, you know, was like the thing that sold 3DS systems, it felt like, early on. And the team that worked on that, Grezzo, you know, Nintendo reached out to them to make Majora's Mask 3D, which came out in 2015, which is pretty late in the 3DS timeline. And the what in the world changes kind of made their way in. There are some, you know, quality of life things. There were times when the asset reuse kind of bit them in the ass, like when they used a sign that in the Hylian language said, you know, the wrong name of a ranch, you know, stuff like that. People complain about the visuals in the 3DS version. All that I can think is like, it is less like just visually dark. Like things are just a little bit more bright and sharp.
Yeah. Right? I think things are just more distinct in general because it's not an N64 game, but there are a lot of like editorial changes to this. I don't like, I do in general like the 3DS version, but like we discussed earlier, they overcomplicate the boss fights. When you have to fight the bosses again to activate the world change, the world state changes, and it can be annoying. It's like, especially the names are not coming up through my brain, but the water boss, the boss of the water temple.
Yes, yeah.
They made that extra fish irritating, and I didn't want to have to fight it even once. But things like changing the swimming controls was a terrible idea. The swimming used to be so elegant and smooth and fun in the N64 version. It just became like an awkward chore in the 3DS version. But yeah, many of the improvements are great. I just don't know why they did these like system level changes to different areas of content.
Yes. The boss changes, it feels like they made it more modern.
Yes, weirdly. Yeah.
Yeah, like by having phases for a lot of them, and by adding in the weak points, the eyes that would pop out after.
Yeah, I guess it made
them,
it more like visually coherent because it's like, oh, these are all from the Majoraverse, the Maskiverse, or whatever you want to call it. But
yeah,
in the N64 version, I love sitting down and fighting the boss you fight as a Goron. It was just fun. It was just like a very fun, quick boss fight that you could knock out in like 90 seconds, 2 minutes. It becomes much, much longer and more involved in the 3DS version. And it doesn't feel like the game was intended for that, for you to really sit with the bosses for a while.
No, especially the twin mold fight.
Yes.
That was one that really annoyed me in this version. And I did not remember it being. I looked up the description. I was like, yeah, everything that annoyed me about this fight was added for the 3DS version. That I think is bad preservation. I don't know if preservation was their goal when they set this out, but like, I don't know. It was more than they probably ought to have done.
Yeah. There should have been an option for you to have the original bosses and their original rules they played by. We're seeing certain things like that in the new Metal Gear Solid 3 remake, where it's like, okay, there are these tweaks we do for modern people, but if you want to play with the stinky old controls and with the old AI, well, that's on you and you can do it. But here there is no choice. It's like you have to play in the mindset of a 2015 gamer.
Those are the ones that people tend to focus on when they're complaining about it. Like the quality of life stuff, you know, I emailed you a couple weeks ago because I was sitting down to replay this and I was like, okay, do I play the N64 version or do I play the 3DS version? Because I can play the N64 one on Switch. I have the rewind and the save states and stuff. I'm happy I went with the 3DS version, specifically because of things like being able to select the hour that I want to jump forward to, right? I would not have wanted to jump to 6 p.m. and then wait for 10 p.m. for something to happen, right?
And the changes are very granular. I believe one of the changes is you can kind of reload the same bookmark save over and over, where in the N64 version, it deletes the save once you load it. So it's just like, I'm saving my place in the game. I can't go back to this if I screw up, but they are very, very forgiving in the 3DS version.
Yes. They also let you save, mid cycle. Mm. I think it was like the bookmarkers, like state save, only when you got to the, got to the owl statues in the N64 version.
Right. Right. Yeah. So yeah, there was an appeal in the original version where it's like, you're walking the tightrope. Your only hard save will come when the cycle is over. What can you do in that time period? And then if you need to step away, you have the bookmark saves. And I understand how that is not very tenable in 2015 or 2025, but there was something to that I miss a bit.
Yeah. Made things feel a little bit more dangerous.
Yeah.
I think.
But now I don't have time for that, unfortunately.
No.
In the year 2000, sure.
Yeah. 2025, no. So the N64 one had the awkward hardware thing with the expansion pack. And then, like, this is something I think is going to be lost to history a little bit when people talk about the 3DS, the weird little half-generation jump they did with the new 3DS and the Circle Pad Pro, because this came out right around the same time that did. And suddenly, you know, they give you the ability on that weird little Lenovo mouse nub thing on the new 3DS to control the camera on your own.
Yeah, I never liked that nub. I thought it would be great. I thought I'd be using it a lot, but it's a little too stiff. And honestly, the game gives you the functionality to move the camera pretty freely, I think, on its own.
Yeah. I never played the 3DS version without the nub, but I mean the camera controls in Ocarina of Time were fine. You know, you at the very least had the ability to center behind you whenever you wanted. You know,
yeah. I think a big plus that I didn't mention to you about the 3DS version that should be apparent, like as soon as you start playing, is like so much of the game is about firing your bow and arrow, because like all the dungeon treasures are arrows. And you're doing a lot of slingshotting, a lot of bow and arrow, and the gyroscope controls are very nice when you go into first person.
Yeah. Yes. That is something I love about the Steam Deck, too, is being able to do fine stuff. I like that about the Steam controller, actually, having the gyro aiming. It is welcome here. Yeah. Anything else about like the development of the 3DS version that that we haven't touched on here?
Yeah, I'm just looking over some of the notes I wrote. That's basically it. I feel like I really want to know where these games are going to end up, because there's no digital marketplace for them anymore. They're very expensive to buy boxed. And I'm wondering, will there be the 3DS Virtual Console? What will the two-screen solution be when you're playing on a Steam, sorry, not Steam, Switch 2. I feel like I don't want to leave this generation as completely inaccessible, because these remakes are worth playing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I feel that way. Well, whichever one you want to play, if you're going to revisit after you listen to this, that's between you and your God.
Mm-hmm.
So. Thank you. So let's get into it. This opens up. This is one of the few direct sequels to a Zelda game. You pick up shortly after, I think it's a few months after Ocarina of Time, and Link is moving on like the Hulk, kind of.
Because the resolution of that game is what? Essentially, he made it so like none of his actions ever happened.
Yeah. So nobody recognizes him as the hero. Reset the timeline so Ganon never takes over. And even Zelda only kind of barely remembers you at the end of that. I remember being bummed out about that when I played it again as like a 10-year-old. So yeah, he's out riding through the woods and he gets waylaid not just by Skull Kid, but by two fairies. Like the fairies are set up in ambush. knock him over.
And I don't know what their names are in Japanese, but this is one of the most brilliant localization choices that their names are Tattle and Tail, but they're both spelled like in fantasy versions of those sounds.
Tattle is spelled like a startup.
Yes. It's like an app you use to report your neighbors to your HOA or something.
Exactly. They might as well just call that next door, actually. But Skull Kid, who is just a minor NPC in Ocarina of Time, he's here and he's wearing this strange mask. I love the design of Majora's Mask.
It's a fantastic little creation. I've never seen anything like it. I guess they are taking from like quote unquote tribal visualizations in terms of what the art looks like, but it's just so spooky and unique.
Yeah, the perfectly circular eyes and like that combination of the purple, red, and yellow. Mm-hmm. I don't know, there's something about the coloration. It just feels like an iconic design to me. But like Skull Kid takes the Ocarina of Time, takes Epona, and drags Link into the realm of Termina bodily. Like, you know, just carried along with his horse. Into a short tutorial dungeon. What I like is this does assume that you have played Ocarina of Time. It doesn't spend a lot of time easing you into how to maneuver a Link.
Yeah, it's all the basics where it's like the jumping is contextual. Here are the different kinds of attacks you can do. And it's all set within this like very, very spooky dark forest.
Yeah. And it's framed as a chase too. Like you're trying to, you know, catch up to this guy who took the stuff that matters to you. But you catch up to him and he decides to play a prank on you. This is what Skull Kid is going to do. This is how he has been ruining the world of Termina, is by doing mean-spirited pranks that have kind of these cosmic consequences to them. He decides to turn you into a Deku scrub.
And the point of the game is hurt people.
Yes. Never, ever stop being a friend with somebody because they might slam the moon into the earth.
I guess we find out later he's just a sweet, wounded bird boy.
Yes. And the Deku transformation is horrifying. The images of like all of them kind of like surrounding Link and just closing in on him and stuff. The scream. I like that you can skip the mask transformations things after this, you know, just when you're switching between them. But it does look anguishing to go through this.
They do make you watch it the first time just to let you know it is infecting his face and body. And this will be revealed later in the game, but it's like we learn this character died and left this mask behind. This character died and left this mask behind. Who eventually dies or who died before you got here is a very tragic story that is revealed like very subtly through dialogue.
Oh, it's in the credits. Actually.
Oh, it's in the credits. Okay. I know that character might say a few things about it, but I guess the credits fully spell it out to you.
Yes. Yeah. It's the Deku butler. Mm-hmm. This is his kid who died. I don't know under what circumstances, but he alludes to some kind of tragedy that he has. And you see him kind of like crying over the tree that the scrub's body became in the credits there. And you come out in the basement of the clock tower of Clock Town, kind of the world at the center of this, of Termina. And you meet the happy mask salesman, who is, real upset because that mask belonged to him. And he says, hey, if you get this back, if you return the mask, if you get the thing that was taken from you that mattered, you know, that you cared about, that was important, I can turn you back. But you have 3 days because I'm going to be leaving town. He doesn't say because the ding dang moon's going to crash, but yeah.
He's got this great hideout with his organ and everything. Mm-hmm. Very atmospheric.
Yeah. And his, again, creepy little smile, and just the overall menace, and the amazing way that it's shot, like the blocking, like of the quick cuts as he gets mad too, like all the different angles around him. And you come out into Clock Town, which is relatively small, but there are tons of buildings you can go into. And you're stranded. You cannot leave the town, and you're in this kind of like, you are trapped trying to solve your Deku Scrub problem over the course of these 3 days that you have nothing, you have no way to affect the descent of the moon, and very little to, you know, very little at the start in terms of what you need to be doing to fix yourself, right?
Yeah, you're really disempowered. Everybody hates you. They're kind of racist against Dekus. And I feel like there is a bit of they're projecting a bit of this. I feel like the Deku feel a bit like Chinese merchants, the stereotypes you see with those folks in Japanese media. And they're receiving the same kind of racism from the people around them.
Yeah, there's a real sense of like, you don't belong here. Like down to the point where like a dog chases you.
Yeah. A cute little Scotty Doug. Yeah, the sense of the hostility, the sense of disempowerment really threw a lot of people off. And we mentioned Tattle, and a lot of this game is customer service because we're like, what didn't you like about Ocarina of Time? We're going to fix it. Tattle doesn't say, hey, listen, there's like a little bell ringing, which is a lot more soothing than the fairy voice. But what Tattle did in the N64 game that she does not do in the 3DS game is insult you. So a Navi would give very helpful advice. And when you ask Tattle things, she'll reluctantly give you a hint, but she'll be like, oh, you are, I guess you are too stupid to figure this out, aren't you? So I don't know why, but that was such a nice touch. And that is not in the 3DS version. They will not let Tattle insult you in this newer report.
Use a shield to block the rock from this Octorok, you clod.
Yes.
I forgot about that detail. Tattle does stay with you. You got separated. You're going to see later on, she stays with you because she sees that Skull Kid is abusing, Tally or Tail or whatever their name is, the other, her brother. Dialogue kind of tells you like, hey, you have this mystical problem. You need to go, talk to the great fairy here. And this is just a tutorial teaching you a little bit about the capabilities of the Deku Scrub. Let's talk about those, by the way, because like you start as it, and it can kind of feel like the base state. So the Deku Scrub is very small, has like a spin attack that he does, instead of a slash, and can spit bubbles. That kind of floats slowly toward your target and then explode to do damage.
Right. And there are some light flight powers in which you can burrow into these flowers that exist on the map and then shoot up out of them. And then you have a limited time to hover to wherever you need to go.
Yes. And you can bomb using Deku Nuts, which are like little flashbang kind of things. They do a lot with the platforming of being able to launch and then fly. And they show you that here. Like one of your goals is to do this delivery chain in order to get access to the flower that'll let you get to the top of the clock tower. Right. But it's teaching about the great fairy. It's teaching about the stray fairies, rather. You've got to reassemble the great fairy, go and catch the ones there. You have to do a very, to my mind, annoying hide and seek quest with the local child gang.
Yes, the bombers. This is some of the quests aren't as inspired as you want them to be, but again, they had to do a lot of them, and there was a lot of crunch. So I totally get it. But I love this part of the game so much. I wish I can go back to the time in my life where I didn't know what to do immediately, because you're just in this small space, essentially like four quadrants, north, south, east, and west, and you have to kind of get to know everybody and try to figure out based on clues what you need to do next. It's very fun to play for your first time because it does feel threatening and you are very powerless at this point.
You are. And also, like, as the 3 days progress, things get far more stressful because you notice this big moon in the sky that has an angry face is getting closer and closer. And a detail that I noticed on replaying the 3DS version that I'm sure I noticed back at the time, but feels very pronounced here, is that the music speeds up as the time limit approaches. So by the end of your last day, you are still disempowered. It's
it might be very unclear what you need to do, and the music is moving at like 3x.
Yeah, the clock tower music is no longer soothing as it used to be in Johnson.
No. You end up going to the observatory and looking through a telescope to find out where Skull Kid is. He's on top of the clock tower, and he basically moons you when you look at him.
Yeah, he slaps his ass.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they left that in the 3DS version. I'm pretty sure.
They did.
Like, yeah, he bends over and just slaps his ass, giggles at you.
So that's where you need to go. And you get access to the flower that will, you know, let you launch up there. You can only get in. There's like a pendulum that moves out of the way of the way up to the top to confront Skull Kid and try and get back what you need. But this mask has given him, you know, enough power to hold you off, especially as a Deku scrub, right? And time runs out. And the goddess of time speaks to you and says, hey, you're going to need to play this song in order to, you know, solve all of this. And you play, you get the ocarina back, you knock it out of his hands and you play it. And then you go back to the beginning. You go back to when you arrived. The mask salesman recognizes what's going on and is very upset that you got your ocarina, but not his mask. and tells you a little bit about the mask. Like, this was something that was used for like evil rituals, like sorcery kind of stuff. And it is kind of like taken on this kind of curse from all of that.
And you are in boy form at this point, right? The curse is broken and you get the mask. Okay.
Yeah. When you bring the ocarina to the mask salesman, he teaches you, I think, the song to cure yourself or to rest, make the spirit rest. And that causes the mask to pop off. So now you are playing as the Link that you remember and know. But we have our goal. These four regions have been corrupted by Skull Kid. You have to go to each of them and solve the problems, and that will give you what you need in order to stop the world from ending here.
Yeah, and I guess for certain folks, the game is not putting its best foot forward when, as soon as you're given freedom, you have to go to the swamp.
It's not
quite a sewer level, but it's not like
it's not a sewer level.
Yeah, it doesn't feel good. I mean, I love the game and I love this portion, but it's like, oh great, I gotta like trudge through some muck now.
Yeah, especially with the Deku Scrub, because you can't swim, and the swamp that you're going to is at the south of the world map. The water is poisoned, so you couldn't really swim in it anyway. But the Deku Scrub, you know, Link can swim, but he can only like skip across the surface.
You get a few skips before you sink. And like I was saying earlier, a lot of the game is customer service, and part of that is, oh, we didn't have the Legend of Zelda theme in Ocarina. Well, here it is. We brought it back. So you will hear the classic Legend of Zelda theme. And to me, I'm like, well, that's fine. I kind of wish you would have written more new music, but I understand that people really wanted this.
Yes. It didn't feel like a Zelda game without it to them. Although I liked the original Overworld song as well that you had. So there are some side quests that you can do just by exploring. I think one that is really important is to start your mask chain. You get a mask that lets you lead a little animal parade, and you use that for this guy. I forget his name, but it's like Grok or Grud or something like that. And he wants to see his chickens grow up. He wants to see his cuckoos grow up because he knows the world is going to end and they're not going to get a chance to be adults. So he's all bummed out by that. You have to lead a little Pied Piper parade around playing the ocarina, gathering up all these chicks in this field near the farm. And then they, one by one, they pop like popcorn, turning into full-grown cuckoos.
Yeah, I totally forgot that was the reason why you're doing that, because he realizes these little babies are going to die without reaching their full form. That's very sad.
It is very sad. He's really bummed out for these little dudes. And they're really cute. They look like little lemons kind of marching around behind you. But this gets you the bunny hood, which lets you move faster and thus means you have more time to do whatever you're going to do once you get where you're going.
Yeah, one of many reasons to never get on the horse unless you're
Yeah, no. Yeah. Love you, Epona. No dice. Not going to use you. So we go to the Southern Swamp. And we learn the Song of Soaring here. This is fast travel. This is very welcome to be able to do this. You unlock checkpoints that you can get to, like one roughly at the beginning of a region and one right outside the dungeon once you get there. And we find out the water is poisoned. We have to do a Lost Woods because it's not Zelda if you don't have Lost Woods.
Right. And it's essentially the same kind of puzzle that was in Ocarina of Time. They are reusing some puzzle ideas just because they need puzzles. And they know they have the programming set aside for this kind of puzzle. Just slide it right in.
It's just, okay, it's not asking you to listen for the music to get louder when you get to an exit. You have to chase a monkey.
Right, you're following a monkey. So I guess it's a tiny bit different, yeah.
It's a tiny bit different. I think there is another way you can do it to find a mushroom to get a cheaper source of the blue potions. Hmm. Or at least maybe the green potions. I'm not sure. The witch that you rescue is the person who runs this boat tour that can get you into the poison water, taking you to the Deku Palace, which is another bad foot to put forward. Everybody's favorite section of Ocarina of Time. You know, eat your heart out, bottom of the well. People clamor for the Hyrule Castle stealth section.
Yeah, this one, I remember being a bit rougher on the N64 version. Ultimately, it's not too demanding, but you're not given the tools you have like in Metal Gear Solid, not even like the cones of vision on a mini map. So I think thankfully they just boot you out to the beginning, but it's still very frustrating when they do.
Yeah. But you get in here, you know, if you walk in as a Deku scrub, you find out that there is this monkey who has been accused of leading the princess into the corrupted temple for her to die. And he's about ready to, I think the implication is they're going to roast him on a stake and eat him.
Yes. See, this game is dark. There's monkey execution is on the menu.
There's there is monkey devouring going on here.
He can speak. Eat that monkey with their little snouts.
Yep. They're going to plant their roots into him and suck out all of his water and nutrients. He can speak. He teaches you a song. He teaches you what you need to, the song you need to play to raise that temple to get in.
Yeah, I guess a lot of the songs in this are filler, but I guess that was the case for Ocarina of Time too. It's like this song will just open this dungeon period. That's it. There's no other functionality, correct?
Yes. I remember like there are not as many of them in that are just that in Ocarina. I think a few more of them have some function than this, but there are a few like either that you get here to open a dungeon or that you get as a reward for finishing a dungeon. And it is only used in a few different kind of like side quest kind of things. Yeah. But we get into Woodfall Temple. This is probably the weakest of the dungeons to me. And I think it is because it is the only one that is not vertical.
Yeah. It's not very memorable to me. I just remembered it being very intimidating and dark when I first played this game. A lot of it because you just get the bow. Which arrow do you get in this? Or just the bow period in this?
You just get the bow.
Okay. And then successively you unlock the next three arrows through the next three dungeons.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So you just get the bow here, but the bow is really empowering here, you know, and you can use it to light stuff on fire. Like it really, like this leans on two things. It is using the Deku flowers to glide over poisoned water. So there's a lot of like you fall and you have to backtrack kind of problems. Do not poison me with, or do not punish me rather, by making me, you know, go back three or four screens before. I dislike that. There's a lot of torch lighting in this too. You have to use the Deku sticks before you get the ability. I mean, that's the next dungeon where you get the ability to use the fire arrows to light stuff. But like,
right, so a lot of it is about keeping that stick lit while you're traversing to the torch or whatever you need to burn the spider web, etc.
Yes. Yeah. It's like I clear the way there and then I, you know, light the fire and then, you know, carry it across there. Pretty basic stuff. Barely counts as puzzles. We just call them Zelda tasks.
Yeah.
Use Zelda across a room.
Yes. Step on the switches, light the torches, open the door, etc. Find the key.
Defeat all the enemies. You know.
Yeah.
Do whatever you need to do to raise the bars and hear the little tune. You have mini bosses in these dungeons too. All of them, I think they get a little bit more substantial than this later on, but there's the dino foals, the lizard swordman, which doesn't feel too terribly different than fighting a Stalfos to me, really.
Yeah. This guy completely forgettable. It's just, they're giving you a beefier, regular enemy to fight. Yes. There's no real gimmick to this guy.
Yeah, there is a gimmick to Snapper and the Gecko. This is a Gecko kind of looking lizard guy that is riding a turtle. And this relies on you getting under, you know, getting into a flower, goading him to ride over you, and then blasting out when he is over top of you to upend him and then take out what you need to take out.
Yeah, this one is memorable and fun, and I like how you're using the Deku power to for an offensive means instead of just to transport yourself to another area or like another flying over a pit or something like that.
Yes, and it's not strictly apparent when you're in here that there is an offensive capability for this. Mm. I think there were some turtle enemies in the Lost Woods that you might have been able to deal with by doing the launch trick. It wasn't necessary, like it is here. So it feels like a creative use of the powers here. So the boss of this temple, masked jungle warrior Odolwa, I remember this being the standout, like really cool boss fight from the N64 version.
Yeah, it's very intimidating because it's just this huge tribal warrior with a giant sword, and you're like, well, what do I do?
Yeah, it is a sword duel. In its original form, like you are looking for openings, you're trying to create openings. In the 3DS version, they had to make it feel a little bit more modern. There had to be a trick to it. So they give you Deku flowers so you can fly over and then bomb him to stun him and make the big eye bulge out to do damage to him. I preferred it when it was this really intimidating sword fight.
Yeah. Like, I appreciate them trying to reevaluate these boss fights, but I think they were just overthinking it. And they do feel like a more modern boss fight in this game that is not the home for your 2015 boss fight.
No. But when a boss dies, they leave behind a heart container. They leave behind their mask. And when you pick it up, you warp to Celestial Giant World. These really goofy looking torsos that are also nose faces with big lanky arms and legs.
They feel like the evolution of Mr. Saturn from Earthbound.
I was trying to remember what these reminded me of. That is a good poll. I don't know. I would need to ask somebody who is more knowledgeable of this stuff, like if this design is like pulled from some yokai that I don't know about or some, you know, representation. I think they just look really goofy. Also, they speak very slowly.
Yeah, but just it's in general with the keeping with the strange designs. These benevolent creatures. You think at least they're benevolent. They're going to save the world at the end. But they're very creepy looking, and the fairies are very weird looking in this game too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get the naked lady fairies covered in ivy in this one. Yeah. But they say, hey, you need to rescue my siblings. And also I will teach you the song, this oath to order that I cannot remember using once.
Yes. What does this song do? When I saw this in the notes, I was like, I have no idea what this is.
Nope. No recollection. I wrote that down. It seemed important that he taught you a song. Something I didn't call out before, the different forms have different instruments, which I remember being very enamored of back when I first played.
Yeah, and for the Deku, it's a set of bagpipes, right?
It's like horns. It's like these horns that grow out of his back.
Oh, yeah. Kind of so they're like part of him, essentially.
Yeah. And they sound like it's that really fun little, just a sample of like a kind of like a trumpet, like a blat kind of sound on them.
Yeah. Real funky MIDI sound. I guess the Oath to Order is basically the song you play at the end of the game to just summon all the giants to lift the moon.
Oh, okay.
So it just has one use.
Okay. Pretty important use, though.
Yeah.
But you've beaten the temple, and the swamp is now no longer poisonous, and you rescue the princess. And this is a famous and funny moment. The princess, you need to get her back to the castle. And instead of saying like, hey, I will follow you, you clear the way. This is not an escort mission. She says, oh, you have a bottle. I'll just get in one of those.
That's great. And I like the little icon of her crammed in the bottle. And also, this does feel like customer service to me in a good way, where the Nintendo is saying, the Zelda team is saying, oh, you hated that escort mission with the princess in Jabu Jabu's belly. Well, she's just going to climb into a bottle. And then in your notes here, Cole, you're mentioning the Skullchilla houses. That feels like them answering another complaint where Me and a lot of other people hate all the spiders in Ocarina of Time. There's just too many goddamn spiders. And they're like, okay, we put all of the spiders in two houses and they're optional.
Yes. You'll find this, you'll find the odd stray Skulltula on your way there. But like, there are two little mini dungeons you can do that are scavenger hunts for the gold Skulltulas. In Ocarina of Time, it is like a game spanning, like, spot the hidden item, listen for the scrabbling feet kind of thing or whatever. Here, I think I do agree it is an improvement, kind of keeping it like you don't always have to keep your ear open for those. You just have to when you're in these in this area, and it tells you how many you found every time you pick one up.
Your time limit is the 3 days. Well, it's that's how long you can take. Like with anything in the game, it's not like, okay, you have a minute to do this. It's like spend as much time as you want, but you have to do it all in one cycle.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good it's a good change, I think. But we take the princess back and we get the monkey off the dinner table. And things are all set there. Now that we have the arrows, we can do some mini games around town. I didn't make notes of these because they are just things that you do to get the heart containers, right?
Yeah, yeah. These don't stick out as much to me as the quests. And yes, a lot of the quests involve things that could otherwise be mini games you would activate in other ways, like the archery on the dairy farm.
And also the archery that you do, like the rail shooter that you do defending the caravan or defending
that is
the wagon.
Very cool.
From the bandits here. Although one that sticks out that I do remember remember from playing back in the day was you can go to the post office and talk to the postman, and he plays a game which is, do you know how long 10 seconds are?
I tried to do this just on a whim on the 3DS version. It was very difficult, and I wonder if emulation screws this up. I mean, it sounds like you played the Switch version, Kay.
No, I played the 3DS version.
Oh, the 3DS.
For this.
Yeah. I wonder if just like emulation being always just a tiny bit off will mess with this.
I don't know.
For players today.
Yeah. It only took me a couple of tries here, so I'm not sure. And I've no idea how this would have been in Europe with PAL if that was adjusted at all. Like the different clock speeds and stuff. But I just remember this one giving me fits as a kid. I went and got a stopwatch. So I could just cheat at this.
Yeah, I might have used the clock app on my iPhone, but I still really couldn't do it.
Yeah. So we can go to the next region here. We can go north. Now that we have the bow and arrow, there is a big block of ice blocking the way up into the mountains, and there are like icicles hanging over it. With the bow, you can knock those down. And we get into this mountain that is having this unnatural winter, and all the Gorons who live here are freezing. You see each of them, they're all bundled up and shaking, kind of hugging themselves.
These guys can't solve their own problems.
And not at all.
In order
no agency.
To, yes. They'd all they do is sit around eating rocks all day, these guys. And just to make this atmosphere seem even more oppressive, there's just a baby constantly crying. And I do find this irritating, but I understand why it's there. And they want you to look at, the baby is crying, you need to solve this problem.
Emergency. Everybody's favorite part of Yoshi's Island.
And what it just it plays just on a loop.
But yeah, the king's son is crying because his father went missing. The great hero of the village is gone. In order to find him, you do have to do something with that fucking owl who always interrupted you in Ocarina of Time.
And this time it is, he reveals the platforms that are lost in the snowstorm. You can't really see them because of the snowstorm.
They're just straight up invisible.
Okay.
So he says like, hey, follow me. And you have to take like leaps of faith across these invisible platforms that are kind of at an angle to you. So it's unpredictable, like where they start and where they end.
And
it just flies across.
You can see a shadow that's a big clue as to what is safe.
Maybe the snow stops falling. I might be thinking of the Crystal Cave from Dark Souls.
Similar idea. No owl to help you though. You're on your own.
No, very few owls. But you get across and you find the Lens of Truth, which uses up some magic and lets you see invisible things. This lets you see some handholds on a cliff to go up to a shrine where you will find the recently deceased spirit of the hero of this kingdom, Darmani. You play the song to soothe him, and he turns into a mask, which seems like a weird burial to me. And you can turn into a Goron. What can the Goron do?
My favorite thing is just tear ass around Termina. Just, I love when I'm out of resources in this game, I love just doing laps around the Clock Town, the outside of Clock Town, and just blasting through everybody, destroying bushes, going over ramps. That is, and also he punches too, but I just love basically Sonic the Hedgehogging my way through this game.
It is so fun to control. Like, there's the sense of momentum and speed that you get off of the back of that. There's one time when it gets really annoying at the very end of the game, but I love the Sonic the Hedgehogging. I agree that is good as well. You can also, like, instead of having a shield, like, you can't move while defending, but you can, like, completely turtle up. But that's Goron. Also, you have these fun, like tom-toms, like bongo drums, that play the tunes. And like you need this and spring water from the shrine where you get, you know, get him there to, learn the Goron lullaby and get up to where, Snowhead Temple is, where the elder was heading, to try and stop this blizzard. They think that the blizzard is coming from this invisible big Goron that is blowing the strong wind across. Or no, he's snoring, and that's right. Blowing that blows you off of the thing.
I can't for like, is there a reason why he's invisible?
I think that's just what he does.
Okay, it's just his thing.
What if that was just something his body did?
Sure. Yeah. Get sleepy, turn invisible. I wasn't sure if there's like, oh, it's an evil spell on him, but you can't see him. You can't see him without the lens of truth if you look up at the mountain.
Right. Yeah. You gotta see that he is asleep and then kind of discern that you use the Song of Awakening to get his ass up. But he moves out of the way and you can get into a real standout dungeon here. Probably my favorite in the game, Snowhead Temple.
Yeah, this is my favorite dungeon of the game. And I just love progressing up this tower and how you have to often like double back and go back to certain rooms. It just is very satisfying to like slowly clear it all out once you reach to the top.
Yes. Real big kind of notes of the Eagle's Tower, I think, in Link's Awakening to me.
Yeah. Better, I guess, better mapping in this game. But yeah, very similar idea.
Yeah. You are using your Goron powers to do sick jumps over ramps, and also to smash these ice statues, that will blow you off of narrow platforms. A problem that I do have with this though is, if you fall, you don't just go back to the last, kind of safe ground you were on. You do end up, falling into lower floors, maybe eventually getting to the basement where everything is, you know, lava and stuff. It is a little bit of a hassle to climb back up.
I've had to fight my way out of that basement a lot. So yeah, so it's like, it's just, instead of just saying, oh, you fell, let's put you back where you were. It's like, okay, what are you going to hit on the way down? That's where you're going to start up again.
Yeah. The mini boss here is the Wizrobe. This is a fun fight to do once.
Yes.
They make you do it four times.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I remember doing this a lot, and it works the same way. Okay, he starts running around, just go into first person, and then wait for to see where he's going to materialize, and just aim your bow in that direction. It's that simple, really.
Don't get too close, or he'll run. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like there's a little bit of a feint to like, in the later phases, he does like illusory kind of things, but is super apparent which one is real. So. It's a neat gimmick. I do not know that it is a neat enough gimmick to warrant two times, let alone four.
Yeah, it does feel like this is a symptom of we have no time for all these mini bosses. What can we reuse?
Yes. Let's reuse this classic Zelda enemy. Why not? The item that you get from this, because they are all either the bow or arrows, it's the flame arrows, work just like the ones from Ocarina of Time. They will light torches, they will melt ice, which is the important thing here. And kind of the last leg of what you're doing, you have to raise this central pillar, but it is too tall.
Yes, and I love this. Maybe this is why it sticks in my mind, because you are changing the layout of the dungeon itself, not in a significant way, but I just like that idea.
Yes. And also like, okay, I could punch all these discs out. So like you've got to, as the Goron, you know, punch out segments of the tower so it falls back down. But it's like, oh, if I do it all at once, that will make it harder to get these items that I see kind of around the main shaft there. It is a really neat way to have power over the space and recontextualize it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let me get to the boss. This is, even in the 3DS version, you know, with the changes they made to the swamp boss, this is my favorite in the 3DS version. Even with these changes, goat, masked mechanical monster. It's a big robot bull.
Essentially a bull that doesn't really care about you. He just wants to run around in a circle and you have to catch up with him.
He's got the zoomies.
Yes. He just took a shit in his litter box and he's blasting off.
He wants to get away as fast as possible. Yeah.
No, I mean, this is still fun in the 3DS version, but I'm conflating both of these. In the 3DS version, you have to stop and then attack the eye, correct? It's not just a constant race against this thing.
Right. So you can't just like catch up to him and then just wear his health down.
Yeah.
You catch up to him and it's fun because there are ramps. There are little setbacks you're trying to avoid. Like he throws chaff behind him to stop you up. But you catch up to him and do enough damage that he falls over. Then his eye pops out. So you've got to take the mask off, pull out the bow, shoot it with the flame arrows because that'll do the most damage, and then remask and chase after him again three times because it's Zelda.
The original version, I like how you just never stop, and it does feel a lot like the video game Burnout, whatever mode you are, like running cars off the road. I forget which mode that is, the most popular one, but it does feel like it's predicting that kind of gameplay.
You're doing pit maneuvers on the bowl.
Yes. Yeah. I really wish, I guess, I don't know why they thought you should stop in this boss fight with the 3DS version. It just feels like, no. I love it's a race and you have to keep like picking up the magic points or sort of the magic potions as you're going so you don't slow down.
Mm-hmm. So he doesn't, you know, so you don't lose him and then need to catch back up to him or get back in phase with
right.
him. Right. Yeah. I feel very dumb that when we were doing the Dark Souls 2 season of Bonfireside Chat, I didn't call out. This has a very similar arena structure and even like the little bit of fight rhythm as the Executioner's Chariot.
Right. Yeah, I might have immediately thought of that when I got to that boss, but it has been over a decade since I last played that far, I think.
Yeah, it was 10 years and then it was 14 years before that.
Yeah.
So, neat boss fight. Uses the power really well. Like the other ones don't necessarily require you to, I guess the Zora one does require to use the transformation power for it. But it's neat. And it's not like any other Zelda boss before this to me. But you defeat him, you get his mask, you rescue his giant. And now you have what you need to explore the mountain now that it's spring. This involves, if you liked the rolling around, maybe you'll like it a little bit less now because to upgrade your sword, you're going to have to do the Goron race.
Yeah. And it does feel like a lot of this is random chance because you can be in the lead and then just suddenly get knocked out right before the finish line.
Yeah. It is not as neat as the horse race you can do later on, because the horse race does require smart pathing and a little bit of press your luck by engaging with the fence jumping mechanic. Am I approaching exactly the right speed or exactly the right angle?
Right.
Because otherwise I'm going to lose. Opponent will just stop.
And I recall for this, the gold dust, the prize that you win, you have to win it on the first day because the blacksmith needs a certain amount of time to upgrade your sword. So you have to go back and beat this boss again just for that.
Yeah. You also have to be certified for powder kegs.
Yes.
So, but after this, you can buy them down in Clocktown, which is good for the one side quest I can remember where you need the powder kegs other than this. Yeah, that's kind of the big one. Before you go down and with the powder kegs, you can blow open the boulder that is blocking the way to Romani Ranch. This is you can get to that ranch on the third day, usually, because the Mario lookalike is taking a pickaxe to this boulder. Here you can get there on the first day and actually help rescue There's a younger sister and an older sister. The younger sister, what's her name? Romani something. I didn't write it down. Shit.
Yeah, I forget her name because Romani is the older sister, right?
It's the family. It's Kremia is the, yeah. Maybe her name is Romani. I probably should be sure of that.
Yeah, Romani regardless. Is the little girl.
Okay, cool. She says her sister won't believe her, but there are aliens who come and attack the barn at night. And she asks if you can help her with this. Since you have a horse, a pony recognizes you and you learn the song to summon a pony here. And you have the bow and arrow. And this starts like a little defense game when you come back on a night to stop honest to God aliens from getting to the barn, destroying it, and abducting Romani.
Yeah, very memorable, these cow abducting aliens. And this is so memorable to me because you kind of have to spend an entire cycle with these two, because you meet them, you find out what the problem is, you find out when the problem is happening, you train to solve the problem. And then some of the most bittersweet and depressing content in the game is what happens if you fail. It's a bad time for all involved, especially because one of them is a child.
Yes, it is the innocent child who looks like one of Link's minor love interests from Ocarina of Time. I forget the name of that character, Malin, I think.
Oh, Malin. Maybe. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Looks like Malin. She gets abducted. You come back and her sister is just weeping because the only family she has left is gone. And then on the third day, Romani has returned, but she is not talking. She's just staring into space. Something terrible happened. One of the bleaker things to happen in a video game in this era, I think.
Yeah, and I believe the aliens are the Flatwoods Monster. They're designed to look like that. The classic urban legend creature.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know that there was an inspiration on that. I also don't know what the Flatwood Monster is.
Oh yeah, if you look it up, you will see that this is absolutely their inspiration. I only learned this somewhat recently, but it's a very distinct design.
Oh yeah, they do. It's kind of like an onion kind of shape. I always thought they looked a little bit too much like the poles.
They're a bit poish. And this is something I'm glad we have the safeguards built in our modern ways we play Majora's Mask, because if you are playing the old game on the cart with no safeguards, if you mess up this tricky sequence, and honestly, fighting the aliens can be tricky without the gyroscope controls, you start over. And it puts you in a pretty sour mood when you're like, I just want to help these people.
Yes.
I don't want to hear about their slob story anymore. I just want to get to the alien part.
I don't want to do target practice again.
Yeah.
The repetition does on these longer quest lines, and it's egregious in Anju and Cafe quest as well. The repetition that you have to do kind of at the end of the game, if you want to help them. They also mislead you a little bit. The tutorial happens, you're riding Epona and engaging with the horseback archery, which is, it feels cool to do, comma, is really hard.
Yeah.
Much better success doing it off of Epona.
Yeah, yeah. And the 3DS version makes this so much more achievable, just because you're not just fiddling with the N64 analog stick. You have a lot more degree of control. And yeah, there are a lot of close calls in that, because the aliens are getting closer to the cows, and you have to take them out before they get too close.
Yes. Yeah. So it's kind of like spinning plates or something like that. And then you have a follow-on quest you can do, protecting the caravan as they make a milk delivery, now that the boulder is away and now that the aliens are taken care of.
This is very cool. Mm-hmm. This feels like the first time and maybe only time Zelda has ever done a turret shooter sequence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's neat. The music is real rootin' tootin' as well, as you're firing arrows out of the back of this thing.
And you're fighting Evil Luigi. I forget what his name is in this game.
I can't remember. I think of him as Evil Luigi, which is distinct from Waluigi.
Yeah. And he is the guy who is a threat to the, just like he was an evil ranch owner in Ocarina of Time. He disguised himself as a bandit, I guess, in this game.
Yeah, yeah, he runs the like the horse racing, is what it is. It is evil Luigi and a slightly different kind of evil Luigi over there doing stuff.
Yeah, the nice Mario man is not in this game, as far as I know.
He is the ranch hand at Romani Ranch.
Oh, got it. Yes, he's like sleeping in the barn or something like that.
Yeah, he's the one who, when you come here on the first or second day without the powder keg, he's the one who is trying to get rid of the boulder. He's taking the pickaxe to it. Yeah. But this is neat. They give you a mask, the Romani mask, which lets you get into the milk bar in town. Milk is a good healing item, reliable way to get one of those if you would like. You can also buy the Chateau Romani, which is implied to be alcoholic milk that makes it so you never have to pick up a magic. You don't have to refill your magic bar in the same 3-day period.
It's really fun to go here at night because this is where all the adults go to gripe about the end of the world.
Yep.
And the evil Luigi character, he is seemingly drunk on milk.
He is drunk on milk, and he will be cheered up if you help the band leader do a sound check. And the song that you play is the Ballad of the Windfish from Link's Awakening. I forgot that that was in here, so I was playing, and I was like, they couldn't be. Oh, they are. They are doing that. Okay, neat.
And the sound check is essentially you in every form playing a part of the song. So you need to come back with every transformation mask to do this.
Yes. One. Yeah. Yeah. So you have to be the Zora to do the guitar and the have the drums and all that. I think it's real neat. Speaking of the Zora, we can go get that by going to the Great Bay and the Zora Cape down here. Over here to the west. The waters here, because of they're unnaturally warm, they're murky because of algae. And this has led to the guitarist for the famous Zora band. His name is Mikau. He is drowning and you have to rescue him. And he turns into your Zora mask. The Zora form is one of my favorites in this. The swimming did feel good in the original, but also just I like the way he looks and like the boomerang kind of effect you get from being able to shoot his fins is neat.
Yeah, he's essentially like the Zoras are like gray aliens. And I like how creepy he looks, but still like handsome in his own way. And he has like a cool electric guitar that he plays as his instrument. Mm-hmm. Is very neat in this world.
It's they made one of those. They partnered with they made a few of them, I think. Mm-hmm. They partnered with a luthier to make the fish skeleton guitar to like give away for contest winners or something like that. It's real neat. You get this form so you can swim more easily. You can also like put up an electric shield around yourself, to do damage to whatever approaches you, is kind of the capability here. And what you need to do in order to, get to the temple here, the singer of the band, Lulu, her eggs have been stolen by, Gerudo pirates. And, you need to go to their pirate fortress and there are other ones at Pinnacle Rock. They thought, okay, people love the stealth section. We need to cram an even longer one in here with worse consequences for dying.
Yeah, I don't know how or why you would want to do this without the stone mask. And
oh my God.
They make the stone mask very easy to find in the 3DS version. Isn't it just on site?
So in the N64 version, you could go over to Ikana Valley early on and get the stone mask. So you actually could just wear it and, walk your way unnoticed through the entire fortress. Here, you have to get halfway through the Gerudo Fortress. Mm. And it's in an invisible chest underneath the watchtower.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So they made it harder to get in the 3DS version.
They did.
Okay. Yeah, it's been about a decade. Well, actually, it's been a few years since I played through it, but I was thinking like one of what they did something with it I didn't like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it won't protect you from every one of them if it is a weird, like mandatory puzzle thing you have to do. You have to actually engage with that puzzle. It doesn't make it so that the Gerudo captains can't see you.
Yeah, this dungeon is just feels like padding to me, and it's reusing some ideas. Not the best ideas from Ocarina. And you also, I believe, you need 4 bottles free for all the eggs. And this game does give you a lot of bottles, though.
It does, even more in the 3DS version as well. Yeah. So that entails multiple trips. If you don't have all 4 bottles, it's rough. It is real padding-y, only marginally helped by the fact that this is where you get the hookshot. And I am always down for the hookshot. The rest of the eggs are held in this underwater kind of cavern called Pinnacle Rock. To get there, there's like an invisible sign maze, kind of like you would have to follow in Link's Awakening, actually. This is a reprise. The penalty is you have to restart it if you go the wrong way. You can rescue a seahorse, and he will kind of like guide you through it. But you get the eggs from these little Mario 64 eel tunnel kind of things. And very counterintuitively, it is not just having rescued the eggs that helps you. You deposit the eggs in the scientist's tank, and then they form sheet music against the lines at the back of the tank.
That is very cute.
It is very cute. Very Mario, Super Mario RPG of them. And they teach you the new wave bossa nova, not soul bossa nova, not the Austin Powers theme song.
Well, that's too bad. Yeah, it's like once you play the game, you see this tank, and it does have the musical staff behind it, and you realize, like, oh, they were really foreshadowing what's going to happen next.
They were. But this restores the singer's voice. It does raise up a turtle island, and this guy will take you to the temple. If you want to, there are some side quests you can do here. You can help the band get back together for a rehearsal inside the Zora, kind of a city area here, which is cute. And bafflingly, you can get a bottle by racing some beavers.
These guys are so bizarre, but it's just one of the strange touches. Like, who are you? Why are you asking me this?
Yes. You're sore losers. I don't just have to beat one of you. I have to beat the second one. I have to engage with the swimming, the swimming controls in this.
I forget how they changed the swimming in the 3DS version, but I really disliked it. It was no longer fun, and it made things like the beaver race even more difficult.
Your base swimming is very slow, and the fast swimming is appreciably fast, but it does drain mana while you're doing it. So it is a bummer. Otherwise, like, you know, steering underwater is relatively fine. It's just, you're either moving too slow or too fast for whatever, you're trying to do.
Right. I believe in the original version, it was not, you were always just going fast.
Yes. Yeah. The charge thing was just for a defensive crouch, I believe. But this can take us into the Great Bay Temple. I prefer this to the standard Zelda water dungeon because this is not about raising and lowering water levels. This is about altering flow. And right. Instead of having like 6 different versions of the dungeon you have to do, there are 2. There's clockwise and counterclockwise.
Yeah, it does seem kind of confusing at first, and it might be frustrating if you're like, oh no, I wash back into this room. But you eventually like wrap your mind around which tunnels will bring you where.
Yeah. And you're just following these colored pipes and opening up valves to get water where it needs to go. Missing your exit on the little water tunnels is annoying. Sometimes you have to go back through rooms. This can be helped once you get the ice arrow, though, which can create little ice islands, temporary ice islands to platform across and also stop up these waterfalls.
The way it interacts with the water is really neat. It does feel like this should not be happening on an N64, the creation of geometry at my hand, even though it's very basic. You're making a square floating in the water. But again, it does feel like customer service is like, okay, here is a more manageable water temple. We know we received your complaints about the last one. We're going to try to do it again and maybe make it a little more intuitive for you.
Yeah, I remember really dreading this in the run-up to it when I originally played and being like, oh, this is the best water dungeon they've done in a Zelda game. This is great when I played it. They did downgrade the Ice Arrow, and the N64 version, you could shoot the islands wherever you wanted to. This was a sequence breaking thing.
Mm.
Here they made it so you have to shoot sparkles in the water at fixed places. So that is a bit of a bummer and a downgrade. This has two unique mini bosses to it. You have Wart. This is a big eye surrounded by fish egg goo things that you have to drag away. It feels legally distinct from the Goma fight from previous ones.
Yeah, there's Link to the Past fight like this where you are pulling things away with a hookshot to reveal the big eye man in the middle. But yeah, I do like that. This feels like there would be more mini boss fights like this if they had more time, because the next one is a reused one with some extra twists, but still you're kind of doing the same thing.
It's appreciably different because the next one is the Gecko again, but he has slime now.
Mm.
And he's invulnerable until you realize that he, when he's jumping up in the air, you can use the Ice Arrow to freeze the slime. This causes him to fall, and then it breaks and he is vulnerable as you attack him.
So same character, but they managed to work into a new mechanic there.
It's a new gimmick. Yeah. Which is neat. Then you get to Georg,
the gargantuan masked fish. I don't recall having an issue. I played the N64 version like 3 or 4 times and maybe the 3DS version twice. Mm-hmm. And whenever I get to him in 3DS, I'm like, what do I even do here? And this is when I have to go to watch a video because they make it so complicated.
Yeah. In the 3DS version, they put a mask on him, I think, so that you can't do damage to him directly from the front. You have to wait for him to jump over the little island you're on. Do some damage. In the N64 version, I believe you could just do damage by going underwater and cutting the mines loose while he was trying to inhale you. Pull the old reverse Kirby on him.
And then in the 3DS version, based on your notes, and I am remembering this, they add another phase where you have to fight him underwater, and that was really frustrating because it makes you're doing swimming in the context of a boss fight, and I just don't like the swimming in the remake.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't work. In the original one, you could do whatever you wanted. In this, the island goes away. He breaks the island, and then you're forced to do the second one underwater. Not the highlight of the game to me.
No way.
No. But rescue a giant, you get a song. The water's cleared up, but this is not as big of a change. Neither this nor Ikana Canyon have big changes once you defeat here. There's some fishing you can do in the 3DS version. And you can go around and collect frogs to put together a choir, and that's about it.
Yeah, the Goron area is the one place that has all of the biggest changes because the season changes. You're no longer dealing with snow anymore. And I wish they could have been more transformational in the other areas, but we talked about the time crunch.
It's time. Yeah. One standout one, I think, as a real marquee makes sense to me. The only spoke left is to the east. This is Ikana Canyon. This is kind of this desert mountain valley thing that has the lingering spirits of dead ninja folks. The Garo people is what they are. You could come here earlier and do a quest for Dempe, the gravedigger kind of guy, helping him out and learning the Song of Storms. You have to do that because to deal with the Gibdo infestation in the main area, you have to play the Song of Storms to restore the river flow to power up this big music box house that plays the song that wards them off.
Yeah, this is my favorite part of the game in terms of vibes. I don't love playing it as much, especially the dungeon, but I love the idea of this ruined, blood-soaked kingdom. And we see the remnants of it in terms of the undead and the Ikana warriors, these ninjas that you fight. They did change this for the 3DS version. In the N64 version, you fight them and they essentially take their own lives with a bomb to die honorably. It was a really, really dark little touch. I understand why it's not in a 2015 game E for Everyone, but I did love it in the original N64 version.
Yeah. In this one, they'll give you a little pro tip, and then they will say it is customary for an Ikana or whatever these are, the Garo. It is customary for a Garo warrior not to leave a corpse, and then they just poof. It's not quite as suicide bomb-y.
Yeah. I think that's one of the first things my friend told me about this game. It's like, oh, you fight these enemies and they kill themselves.
Okay, edgy.
This is happening in a Zelda game. I gotta see it. I'm
18. I'm a teen. I think this is cool for some reason. But by getting rid of the Gibdos, the mummies, you run into a daughter whose dad is has been cursed to undergo like a slow mummification in the in this basement. There's like a little there's a closet that he's being kept in half mummy form, and it's neat. Like the inside of it's covered with all of the little sealing amulet kind of things.
Right. There's like talisman thingies. And this is pure Resident Evil horror. And I think they knew what they were doing because he literally bursts out of the closet, this half zombified man.
Mm-hmm. And all he can do is like moan at you and like reach out because he's all tied up. You can speak to him if you have the Gibdo mask, and you play the song of healing to fix him. And I think he gives you a hint. He says like, yeah, where you want to go is a Kana castle, but you can't get into that. You have to go to, the nadir of this game, the bottom of the well, area.
This does remind me, I just replayed Earthbound. Good game, by the way, everybody. It's a pretty, pretty rare game. Never heard of it. It's good. Check it out. Seek it out. But The monkey cave in Earthbound does remind me of this. It's a real go-to. It's like you constantly trade items back and forth to open these different doorways, and it's never fun.
Yeah. I don't remember that, but it's been so long since I played Earthbound.
It's always like a bummer. It's like, oh, I'm at this section again. Okay, I'm going to brute force my way through this. And it's a good 20 minutes off your life.
Can I just do Dungeon Man again, please?
Dungeon Man, not long enough.
Oh man, it's a bummer. But yeah, this is a big, all the doors down here are guarded by mummies who are very needy. They need you. They tell you a little riddle of what you need to get to them. And oftentimes this involves leaving the dungeon unless you do the smart thing, which is look up a guide and see everything that you need to bring in.
Yeah, that's a much better idea.
Yes. You get the mirror shield, a little standby here. You can reflect sunbeams onto special blocks to make them disappear. This is how you get into Ikana Castle, which is full of my favorite Zelda enemy, the Rededs.
That's the one complaint they didn't listen to. We hate the Rededs. They're too scary. And they said, no, we want to put them everywhere in at least one section.
Yes. You're gonna freeze when they look at you. You're going to hear the scream. They do make them cuter. If you're wearing the Gibdo mask, they do a little like a choreographed dance in the main hall of this, which is fun.
Yeah, they allow you to cut down on some of the horror a bit with the Gibdo mask.
They can cut it a little bit. But this is a dungeon where you're like blowing holes in the ceiling to create sunlight to get rid of blocks and stuff. Not much to this until a very neat boss fight with the King of Ikana. Which he keeps on regenerating. What you have to do is use the fire arrows to clear off the curtains to create sunlight to reflect at him, to dissolve him.
Yeah, very clever using the environment. And this is, upon a replay of this, I'm like, okay, what do I do? And then it was essentially trial and error, like, oh, the curtains, and then you burn them away.
Yes, yeah. But this gets you, he will teach you a very tedious song that you have to use, the Elegy of Emptiness. Where when Link plays it, he leaves a little Cinco boy behind him, a very creepy wooden mannequin of himself. The other forms also leave behind wooden forms. This is used for switch puzzles.
Yes, this is interesting to me. Mechanically, I hate it because you're just basically creating something to stand on a switch and it takes forever to do. But I feel like the design of this is very interesting because he has realistic-ish facial features of an Asian boy. And I think they were thinking of the audience that would be playing this game. It's like, it's kind of weird to see yourself in The Legend of Zelda. I think that was the intent behind that design of this creepy little statue. It's like kind of more realistic facial features that depict the audience who's playing this first.
Yeah. It's like when Homer hallucinates Bart and Lisa, like if him and Marge were related and they turn kind of photorealistic.
Yes, it's exactly like that. And I play this as like a white 18-year-old, different take on this, but it's just another like, well, what a weird little touch. And I'm glad that they went for this.
Yeah. The rictus grin on him, I think, is a little bit much.
Yeah.
on the wooden doll. To get to the to get to the temple here, the stone tower, you have to do this long ascent up this kind of falling boulder course. You have to play the entire song and watch the entire little scene that plays 27 times to get to the top of this. It is ridiculous.
And with this elegy, you're basically given one little statue per transformation, correct?
Yes. So you have three possible forms. The Deku Scrub is too light to push down a button. Yeah. So you have three possible forms that can push these down. And they don't develop this puzzle idea at all. It is just, here are three switches. Do the chore. This takes you into Stone Tower Temple. I like this. It's another tower. It is frustrating if you're trying to get the stray fairies in it, though.
Yes, that's the only downside. Normally, I can get them all while doing the normal dungeon run. This one, I always have to come back to because there are some very tricky ones. And I just generally, I love the idea of transforming the dungeon. You did a tiny bit of that in the Goron Temple area. Mm-hmm. This one, you are flipping the entire layout upside down. That's really
so. It is so clever. Yeah, you get the light arrow, and that will flip. You go outside and then kind of come back in. So it's like three floors or four floors or whatever, but actually eight because there are multiple versions of it. It is clever. Also, if you do it outside, one of the gravity polarizations causes you to fall upward into the sky forever, and then you respawn. Pretty upsetting. A great mini boss here, the Garo Master, just a powered up and faster version of the normal ninja fight kind of guy. Very few openings. Fun sword duel. And then Gomez, which is a Grim Reaper kind of guy who will just drown you in bats.
Yeah, this one, Gomez is not really ringing a bell, but the Garo Master definitely was very memorable to me.
Yeah. Gomez is like a Grim Reaper. He's got like a scythe and stuff like that. A unique design that has like no dialogue or anything. He just kind of shows up and says, "I'm going to fight you now."
And I guess his projectiles are called bad bats.
they seem to obey him just fine. They're very obedient bats. They just hurt you. So the boss for this. So like the fish was a little bit Shadow of the Colossus-y. This is Shadow of the Colossus. The twin mold, giant masked insect, which is these two flying centipedes. They're gigantic. And on the ground, all you have to do is shoot them with your bow and arrow. In the N64 version, you can find the giant mask, which turns you into Giant Link. You find it over the course of the dungeon, and then you can just pummel them. I think that this does get a little bit added by the extra phase where you have to shoot the eyes on one of them, and then the second one is not vulnerable. The giant mass spawns, and then you get the ability to power up halfway through.
Right. Yeah. I kind of like the changes a bit more. And are you on Epona in the 3DS version? Are you riding? Okay. So it's just you're on foot. And you're firing at it. Okay. Yeah. I guess it was a very impressive on the N64 version as like a set piece idea, but it was over far too quickly. So in this case, I do like them drawing it out. And by this point in the game, I'm not replaying the temples as much or replaying the bosses as much. So I'm okay with a little bit more because it's a very neat atmosphere and a very unique boss fight.
Yeah. Super memorable. And you freed your last giant. They tell you, hey, we will come play this song when the moment is right. And then they give you a little tip. You need to forgive your friend. They're talking about Skull Kid. There's one major side quest we are going to talk about, give a little bit of detail on. This is the most involved one in the game. This involves two characters, kind of a young couple, Anju and Cafe. This spans all 3 days. They're about to be married. But the Cafe has disappeared. You get this from his mom, who says, like, hey, can you help me find my missing son? Gives you a mask. Says, wear this mask and people will know you're looking for him.
Yeah, it's the only way to give Link any dialogue. Just wear the mask and point at it.
Mm-hmm. This is a lot of playing Postman because Anju has been turned into a little kid version of himself by Skull Kid, does not want to appear. Additionally, the mask that he made for his wedding was stolen and he doesn't want to show his face without having gotten this. So you're playing messenger in between the two of them over the course of 2 days. And you find out the mask was stolen by this thief. Who you can run into on the first night stealing from an old lady. We have not talked about Tingle.
Oh, right. Yes.
Tingle, I just realized.
This is Tingle's debut. How did we forget?
That's
another thing that everyone hated about this game. That horrible man.
that horrible, exuberant man. Yeah, Tingle wants to be a fairy. He is 35 years old. You meet his dad in this, who is very disappointed in his child.
Yes.
And he sells maps.
Although he does come to terms with Tingle if you visit him on the last day. I believe he runs like the swamp archery center, or
he's the guy who gives you the camera.
Oh yeah,
He judges the photos that you bring him.
Yeah, there might be like a little redemption for Tingle in his eyes if you visit him on the last day, which no one would ever do that.
No, you dealt with that so much earlier. Yeah, well, that's sweet. But yeah, this is the introduction of Tingle. He's not charging exorbitant prices like I'm led to believe he does in Wind Waker. But yeah, Tingle, fixture of the series for a little bit, had his own game, which I have not played.
Yeah, it has a fan translation. I heard it's kind of fun, made by a pretty kooky developer. I've had the DS version for like probably 20 years at this point, whenever it came out. But yeah, I've been meaning to dig into it just because it's like, well, why would they do this? And like, what do you do in it?
Mm-hmm. So you're acting as a merchant, and has this weird little, like, you have to guess the price that somebody would pay for the item that you get. Hmm. It sounds neat. And just the idea of making a game based around their most off-putting character is fun. But yeah, Sakon, this thief, also annoying. You also find him in the same area, stealing from an old lady. He's the one who took the mask, and he has this hideout in Akana Canyon. And you go to a very you go to a unique dungeon here, where you're doing kind of tandem stuff. You're trying to catch up to this mask as it's on a conveyor belt. It's going to fall and become out of reach. And you are switching back and forth between Link and Cafe. As Link, you are fighting enemies to open a door for Cafe, who has to go and do like a block pushing switch puzzle. In order to open the way for Link, and you kind of leapfrog each other.
Yeah, I have mentioned the Bomber Notebook is very helpful. This is the one where the Bomber Notebook kind of fails you, and it's meant to say, okay, now you're on your own. Pay attention to context clues, pay attention to schedules, and see what you can parse out about this particular mystery in the game.
Yes, and because this spans all 3 days, if you fuck up on the third day, you have to do a lot of it over again.
Yes, I have played on the original card up to the mini dungeon and died there, or had the mask get destroyed there, and that's a bummer, because then you're like, okay, now I got to go through all these steps again. So
yeah.
Yes, I am happy for the non-disposable bookmarks in the 3DS version, and of course save states now.
Yes, of course, save states. But yeah, you get the mask and you get this very sweet kind of scene at the inn, like at the very last moment. Cafe shows up like when there's only like an hour left of in-game time. And they, you know, kind of embrace so they can die as a couple. Although Tattle does take a little bit of the wind out of the sails by remarking, oh, they look like mother and son.
I guess she still has some snotty comments in the 3DS version.
She says it like it's a sweet thing.
Weird take by Tattle. But yeah, this is one of the most memorable moments in video games, especially of this era. This very sweet, bittersweet moment. This couple finding love an hour before the world ends. And
yeah.
you can't finish the game and you know, leave them in this state as a happy couple. It's like, okay, I now have to play the Song of Time immediately and undo all of this.
Yes. Although I think that by fixing what happens here, Skull Kid would never have cursed Cafe, and therefore they just get married. And
right.
Yeah.
You don't know until the ending that it does work out for them, but it is very like tragic in the moment. We're like, well, okay, I am going to wait until the last second to play the Song of Time because I want to see them be happy for as long as possible.
Yes. They there's another like really sad last day thing that we didn't talk about with the Romani Ranch. If you get to the end of day three, like the sisters, the older sister lets the younger one drink the Chateau Romani. Like, hey, you've always wanted to taste this. Here you go. And then like they wait out the last night in bed together, comforting each other as it comes down, as the moon falls.
I mean, this is maybe too dark an interpretation. Some people have said that she poisoned her sister, so she'd die faster before the actual event happens.
I don't know about poison, but just like, hey, maybe like
sedative,
numb her a little bit, so it's not a so it's a little bit more merciful.
I guess it's implied that milk is alcoholic in some way, so she's getting her little sister a little drunk.
Yes. I don't see the poison one. I do see the like live it up kid kind of angle. Yeah. But we have our last mask. If we've been collecting them the entire time, you don't need all of them, but it does let you skip the final boss fight. You go to Clock Tower. You have to wait for it to open. And Skull Kid is there taunting us. And we have a little fight with him. And as the moon is about to fall, the giants appear and they hold the moon up, freezing time for you. His plan foiled. The mask, which has been controlling Skull Kid all along, tosses him aside like a limp puppet and says, well, now I need to go play another game, and flees to the moon.
And the moon is not what you would expect it to look like at all.
It's super surreal. You warp to it, and it is a big, endless field centered around a hill with a tree on top of it. I think it's a Bodhi tree, meditation tree kind of deal. And there are four little kids that look like baby mask vendors, mm-hmm. all cavorting, one with Majora's mask, and then four of them with the mass of the different giants that you've rescued. And you can talk to the other ones, and they say, hey, do you have any masks to give us? And you give them some masks, and they say, come and play a game with me. And you go into a little dungeon that is meant to test you on how well you know the abilities of the transformations that you find.
I replayed this on... Oh, sorry. Okay.
Oh, no. Go ahead. I want to hear.
When I replayed this on 3DS, I did remember it had been a while since I played the game again before. And I remember, okay, you have to do a lot of these mini dungeons. For some reason, I only did a few of them. And then I was able to go to the final boss. And I forget like the mechanics of how many you need to do, or if you can luck out and only have to do a few of them.
I don't know. So at least in the 3DS version, I don't remember in the original. Like the original, you definitely had to get all of the masks in order to get the Fierce Deity mask. You could just go and fight the final boss right away. You only have to do the little challenge dungeons if you want to get the fierce deity mask. In this one, you give them some masks, you do the little challenge, and then you give them some more. By the end, all of your non-transformation masks are gone. And because you don't have any masks to trade or to play with, the one in Majora's mask gives you the Fierce Deity mask because you can't play without a mask. It gives you the thing that'll kill him.
You become very anime. This was a popular character for people who were demanding a mature Zelda. They're like, okay, you at least gave me this character you can barely play as Oni Link or Fierce Deity Link, whatever they call it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's adult Link, slightly taller than adult Link, with white eyes and face paint on, and a cool double helix sword is what you get. You can take this back and go replay bosses with it if you want to. This is just a key for the final boss, which it damn well better be good, because at least the Zora and Goron challenge dungeons are super annoying.
Yeah, not yeah. worth it.
No. Real trial and error. Like one of them's a maze, the other one requires you to steer perfectly or else fall and start it all over again. Regardless, you go and you fight Majora's Mask, who is, super angry, takes you to a cool psychedelic chamber to fight him. And you go through multiple forms. I've never fought him fair.
Same here. And I kind of refuse to. I mean, I'm sure it's fun, but I kind of just want the game to be over at this point, because I've seen all the stories and I'm digging this creepy boss guy, but I'm ready for the ending. So I'm not interested in the additional challenge of not having the Fierce Deity.
No, it, yeah, I'm sure there's a little different little hook for each of the phases. I get the cool thing, which is seeing it go from the mask with the tendrils and stuff off of it to being almost like a Resident Evil Titan or tyrant rather, at the final form. It's cool and creepy. But when the mask is defeated, when the spirit inside it is defeated, the moon dissipates into rainbow energy and the world is saved. We're deposited back at the beginning without the threat of the incoming apocalypse. And Skull Kid is back to his normal self. He's no longer possessed. He recognizes us from the previous game and wants to be our friends. He used to be friends with the giants too. And Link does not get to enjoy the Carnival of Time.
At least day one day.
at least enjoy it. Get some funnel cake or whatever. Come on. But he rides away and we get scenes from across Termina, from across the game. As we, you know, learn about the origin of the Deku Scrub and we see things work out between Cafe and Anju. It's very sweet.
Yeah, these nice little epilogues of all of these, this very small cast you've gotten to know very intimately over the past 15, 20 hours or so.
Yeah. And that's Majora's Mask. Do you have any kind of like final thoughts or wrap up thoughts about the overall game or its place in Zelda?
Oh, sure. I spent a lot of my games career talking about this game and I always like talking about it even more. So I'm happy for the opportunity. And yeah, I feel like unfortunately, the Zeldas to follow were an overreaction to the negative response to this. So it was very much back to the A Link to the Past formatting for even a game with a distinct visual style, a very different visual style like The Wind Waker. And then we have Twilight Princess and then we have Skyward Sword. There, I did remember at that time.
There we go.
And,
yeah.
And I love Breath of the Wild and I love Tears of the Kingdom. I love the direction those games went, but I feel like this Zelda was a very conservative series after this, almost likely due to the response to this game. And I'm happy that it has changed, but I'm sad that it took almost 20 years for it to get into a state where I actually like it. 3D Zeldas. I did finish all of those, but I never want to play any of them again, except for maybe Wind Waker because I've got a soft spot for it. But yeah, I'm glad they can be a little more experimental. It does feel like 2017 Zelda is as weird and as format breaking as this, but it was because it made the choices it did and it was a little more freeing and open. People accepted it into their hearts much quicker than this game, which took 15 years for people to understand, I think.
Right. Like Breath of the Wild felt like a much needed modernization more than anything.
Yeah.
It took risks, but I think the things that people love about it are actually things that made it more like modern games, actually. You know, to a certain degree.
And in this case, it does feel like Majora's Mask, I mean, some parts of it felt like a modern game in 2000, but it was predicting things would be obsessed with 10 years later. Like the limitations and the time loops and the roguelike elements and things like that.
Yeah, it was adventurous and they looked forward. I have no idea how much other stuff that feels like it cribbed from this. Cribbed is a bad way to put it. I don't know how many things explicitly state this as an inspiration, but it has to be a few of them. Like you see seeds planted here that would take a long time to sprout. And you know, I think about my relationship with the Zelda series, and like I've always liked the weirdo ones, you know, Link's Awakening as opposed to Link to the Past. Link to the Past is fine. You know, Majora's Mask, Link Between Worlds. Right. Which was, I think, their first like time dipping the toe back in to making an oddly structured Zelda game. Everybody forgets the Spirit Tracks and the other one for the DS.
Phantom Hourglass?
Phantom Hourglass, yeah. Yes. I'd never played those, so I can't speak to the structure on them. I think that I always associate those more with like DS gimmickry.
Right.
But yeah, I like the weird ones. And I think this is where that was really cemented for me. I will, you know, with Twilight Princess, in addition to a whole bunch of stuff that just made that just have way too much friction to really enjoy, the idea of just going to a parade of dungeons where you get the tool to solve the dungeon and then unlock the next one without an awful lot of extra flavor besides, you know, here is a dark version of the world where that is a little bit more dangerous. That wasn't enough for me. And that caused me to fall out of love with the series for a long time.
Yeah, and it feels like now we're at a crossroads where Zelda can't just do another Breath of the Wild. Like Tears of the Kingdom was them exploring that to its fullest extent to the point where there's just too much happening in that game, perhaps.
It
does feel like a forever game and it's not even online. But I feel like I really want to see what the Nintendo does next because it could be something as weird as this. I don't think they can do exactly what they did before. Otherwise, we're going to be waiting like 8 years between each Zelda game and people might get fatigued by the same kind of ideas over and over. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I just got to say an 8-year wait, not good. Doing something that is more maximalist, also not good.
Yeah. Although in 8 years, I might have finished Tears of the Kingdom. So
I don't know. If we don't do it for the show, I don't know that I'm going to pick it up again. It's just so intimidating. Oh my gosh. Maybe it'll be better on the Switch 2 version, because I also remember having problems with the visuals on it as well.
The Switch 2 version is astounding. It does feel like a new game, and I'm thinking of seriously going back to it, because I played like 2 hours of the Switch 2 version after playing 30 on Switch 1. I'm like, man, this is the version I wish I had started in 2023 when the game released, but obviously that was impossible. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I already own the base one, and the upgrade's what, like a couple bucks?
Yeah, I think it's like $10, but if you have Nintendo Switch Online, you get it for free.
Oh, cool. Yeah. No reason not to give it a shot outside of time. Bob, I really appreciate you coming on here and taking the time to talk about this game. It's been real fun having you.
Well, thank you.
Tell the listeners where they can find you.
Oh, sure. You can find me on places like Blue Sky and Letterboxd as Bob Servo, and Bob Servo most places. And if you listen to Watch Out for Fireballs, you probably heard my other stuff like Retronauts. It's a classic gaming podcast. That's wherever you find podcasts, or patreon.com/retronauts for a bunch of bonus stuff. And I'm also part of the Talking Simpsons Network. We do the podcast Talking Simpsons about The Simpsons. We do What a Cartoon about various cartoons. And we have a lot of miniseries on our Patreon about Futurama and King of the Hill and other animated sitcoms like that. That's happening at patreon.com/talking simpsons. But I just celebrated 10 years on Talking Simpsons, and now I'm in my 15th year of being on Retronauts. So I've been doing this for a very long time, and I'm very happy that I have an audience. And I encourage everybody to check out my stuff if you haven't yet.
Yeah, and Retronauts was one of the shows that made me want to start doing podcasting. It still kind of blows my mind. I'm going to geek out here that we're just buddies with you guys. You're going to be on our Portland Retro Games Expo panel. We're going to be on yours coming up in October.
Yes, yes.
That's October 18th and 19th.
Cannot wait. I'm glad it's happening in later October. I love the mid-October PRGs. I love being close to Halloween.
Yes. At the tail end of September, there's a risk of it still being a little bit too warm.
Yeah. I don't like that. I want a Pacific Northwest fall. I love it.
Yeah. I want the authentic experience. If you have thoughts about this month's games, which are Majora's Mask, Echoes of the Eye, and the premium episode is Against the Storm, or about October's games, which are Mouthwashing, the Silent Hill 2 remake, Cryptmaster, and Fear, go to duckv.tv/contact and write in. The deadline is the 15th of each month. If you have thoughts about multiple games, please separate them into multiple responses, and we prefer responses to be specific and concise. You can back us on Patreon to get the full version of those premium episodes. It's just $5 a month. You get access to the whole back catalog. We think it's a really good deal. If you can't do that, leave a rating or review or subscribe. Do whatever you can on your podcast directory of choice. And of course, join me in thanking our producer, Gwen, who helps us put these episodes together. And until next time, Bob, what can they watch out for?
Watch out for that dumb vulture who steals your wallet in the Overworld.
Oh, yeah. That guy. Fuck that guy. I didn't make a note of him. Yeah.